Welcome to Computing Lives, an author's podcast from the IEEE Annals of the History of Computing. The Annals documents the stories of the information age. It publishes stories of technological innovation, stories of commerce, stories of computing institutions, and also stories of computing people. Moore's Law, the rapid improvement in computing technology, is a central part of that information industry. This podcast is a biography of its discoverer, Gordon Moore. Gordon Moore, who was actually a chemist by training, is a central figure in the history of the semiconductor industry and also of Silicon Valley. He co-founded two major corporations, Fairchild Semiconductor and Intel, and he also guided the development of semiconductor technology there, from silicon transistors to complex microprocessors. He is also known for Moore's Law, the observation that the number of transistors on a chip is increasing exponentially over time. Moore comes from one of the oldest families in California. His great-grandfather, Alexander Moore, settled in California in 1847. He, the grandfather, established Pescadero, a small farming town in San Mateo County, just south of San Francisco. It was in Pescadero that Gordon Moore spent the first 10 years of his life. Moore's father was the local sheriff and eventually rose to the position of chief deputy in the San Mateo County Sheriff's Department. Moore's childhood was a rural one, full of fishing, bird hunting, and trips to the rodeo. In the 1930s, his family moved to Redwood City, and at that time, Moore got acquainted with a chemistry set through a neighbor. He soon became skilled at producing explosives. This interest in explosives led to a deepening interest in chemistry itself through high school and eventually college. After studying at San Jose State University for 2 years, Moore transferred to the University of California, Berkeley, where he received a B.S. in chemistry in 1950. A doctorate in physical chemistry followed from the California Institute of Technology. Moore did his doctoral research in the field of infrared spectroscopy. This dissertation project led him to use and to build equipment instrumentation, including electronics works and glass blowing, that later proved useful in the semiconductor industry. In 1953, Moore joined the Applied Physics Laboratory in Baltimore, Maryland, which was operated by Johns Hopkins University. Dissatisfied with the esoteric nature of his work at the Applied Physics Laboratory, Moore resolved to do something more practical. He also wanted to return to California. This made him particularly receptive to an opportunity presented to him by William Shockley. Shockley, the co-inventor of the transistor at Bell Telephone Laboratories, had recently formed Shockley Semiconductor Laboratory in Mountain View, California. Shockley needed a competent chemist for his new operation. He offered the position to Moore in early 1956. At Shockley Semiconductor, Moore discovered the new world of silicon electronics. He trained himself in solid-state theory and in the intricate techniques required for the production of silicon devices. Moore focused especially on solid-state diffusion, a complex process for introducing dopants into silicon crystals. At Shockley, he also befriended many talented co-workers, such as Robert Noyce. Like Noyce, however, Moore became increasingly uncomfortable with both Shockley's heavy-handed management style and his strategic leadership. Shockley, who had at first focused the firm on double-diffused silicon transistors, was concentrating a growing share of the lab's activities on making an exotic device that was called the Forleo diode. Moore disagreed with this change. As he noted in a memorandum co-authored by Noyce, these devices offered limited commercial prospects, especially when compared with silicon transistors. In the spring of 1957, Moore and six other engineers and scientists rebelled. They asked Arnold Beckman of Beckman Instruments, Shockley's financial backer, to replace Shockley with a professional manager to whom they could report. When Beckman demurred, the group contacted Hayden Stone & Company, a New York-based investment bank, and asked the bank to help them find a corporation that would hire them as a group. Arthur Rock, who was then a young analyst at Hayden, persuaded the rebels to start their own semiconductor company instead. Rock also found an investor interested in backing them, the Fairchild Camera and Instrument Company. Fairchild, which was a medium-sized military contractor based on Long Island, was eager to diversify into semiconductors. With Fairchild's support, the rebels, now joined by Noyce, incorporated Fairchild Semiconductor Corporation in the fall of 1957. The new corporation focused on volume production of double-diffused silicon transistors for both computing and military avionics applications. Moore quickly established himself as one of Fairchild Semiconductor's principal technologists and managers. At first, he took on the development of reproducible solid-state diffusion processes, and he designed, as well as built, the firm's diffusion furnaces. Moore worked on manufacturing processes for creating transistor contacts and showed that aluminum could be used for both the emitter as well as the base contacts of silicon transistors. This was an important innovation, as aluminum became the metal of choice for contacts in all silicon devices. Moore also served as engineering manager. Noyce was actually in charge of research and development. In that capacity, Moore headed the team that developed Fairchild Semiconductor's first product, an NPN double-diffused silicon transistor. This transistor proved to be a smashing commercial success. The first high-frequency silicon transistor on the market, it was rapidly incorporated into the design of airborne computers and avionics systems. Its speed and resistance to high temperatures made it valuable for a variety of military applications. IBM's Military Systems Division used it in the core memory of one of its airborne computers. Another early adopter was Autonetics, which employed Fairchild's device in the guidance and control system of the Minuteman ballistic missile. Under Moore's direction, Fairchild's engineers developed smaller and faster silicon transistors for computing applications. These products were well received in the marketplace and helped transform Fairchild Semiconductor into a leading semiconductor manufacturer. When Noyce became general manager in 1959, Moore succeeded him as the director of research and development. In the following decade, Moore presided over building the most productive and innovative research laboratory in the semiconductor industry. The laboratory also grew significantly, employing more than 600 scientists and technicians. Under Moore's guidance, Fairchild Semiconductor made major strides in silicon technology development. Among the laboratory's most significant innovations was the planar process, which was developed in 1959. The planar process, which exploited the insulating and passivating properties of silicon oxide, made possible the design and production of reliable silicon transistors and, more importantly, the making of a new semiconductor device, the integrated circuit. Devised by Noyce, the planar integrated circuit was put into silicon by the Fairchild Micrologic Group in 1960. These seminal innovations were at the core of the laboratory's subsequent activities. In the 1960s, Fairchild engineers developed ever-faster switching planar transistors. They also engineered innovative transistors for television application. These transistors helped Fairchild open up large markets for silicon devices in consumer electronics. Another major line of work was the development of digital integrated circuits with an ever smaller feature size. In 1961, Fairchild Semiconductor commercialized a family of direct-coupled transistor logic and circuits. This line was succeeded by a diode transistor logic, and then the transistor-transistor logic families. The original direct-coupled transistor family sold particularly well in the computer industry, and it was adopted by firms such as RCA, Burroughs, and Scientific Data Systems. In tandem with product engineering, Moore fostered the development and improvement of manufacturing processes. Among the lab's achievements was the development of more precise and better controlled diffusion and photolithography techniques. These techniques were rapidly put to use in Fairchild Semiconductor's manufacturing plant. Starting in the early 1960s, Moore nurtured the development of the metal oxide semiconductor, an alternative to the bipolar technology then exploited by Fairchild Semiconductor. He launched a major research program on the causes of instability in metal oxide semiconductors. These instabilities were a main obstacle that had to be overcome before they could bring these devices to market. Under Moore's watch, Fairchild Semiconductor's laboratory also made significant contributions to metal oxide device engineering. A special form of the metal oxide silicon transistors called complementary later became the dominant circuit form used in the semiconductor industry. Great attention was also devoted to the development of new metal oxide semiconductor processes, such as the silicon gate process, that made possible the production of denser integrated circuits. In parallel to process and device engineering, Moore supported the development of new computer architectures at Fairchild Semiconductor. A major incentive for this work was a desire to gain internal competency in computing, the main market for the firm's transistors and integrated circuits. Fairchild Semiconductor adopted an unconventional approach to this area, developing a high-level language called Symbol, which implemented the operating system and compiler in hardware. While this project remained experimental, a highly practical development of the Digital Systems Research Group was a new integrated circuit package, which was called the Dual Inline Package, or DIP. The DIP was an important innovation that subsequently reduced the costs of assembling microcircuits on printed circuit boards and thereby enabled the rapid adoption of integrated circuits in the computer industry in the mid-1960s. In early 1965, the editor of Electronics, a leading trade magazine, asked Moore to contribute an article presenting his vision of the future development of electronics, and in particular, integrated circuits, across the coming decade. In the space of 1 month, Moore wrote this article, which would be recognized later as his first articulation of Moore's Law. In the article, titled Cramming More and More Components onto Integrated Circuits, Moore's contended that the future of electronics lay in integrated circuits because of the inherent economics and process technology for manufacturing planar silicon integrated circuits. He stated that integrated circuits were going to lower the price of digital electronics dramatically by incorporating more and more devices on a single silicon chip. Moore noted that the number of transistors on integrated circuits had doubled every year since the development of the first microcircuit in 1960. He claimed that they would continue to do so in the foreseeable future. On the basis of this observation alone, Moore predicted that the number of transistors on a silicon chip would increase from 50 in 1965 to 65,000 in 1975. He also forecast that the exponential growth in the complexity of microcircuits and the corresponding decline in the cost of electronic functions would revolutionize electronic systems engineering. He wrote, "The future of integrated circuit is the future of electronics itself. The advantages of integration will bring about a proliferation of electronics. Integrated circuits will lead to such wonders as home computers, or at least terminals connected to a central computer, also to automatic controls for automobiles, and personal portable communications equipment. But the biggest potential lies in the production of big systems. Computers will become more and more powerful, and they will be organized in completely different ways." Save for a few prominent electronics insiders, Moore's paper garnered limited attention in the semiconductor community up until the mid-1970s. In the latter half of that decade, however, many in the semiconductor community began more explicitly to recognize the development trend that Moore had identified as a fundamental factor to business and technological strategies. Increasingly, semiconductor and computer engineers began to cite a published speech by Moore from 1975, in which he discussed the fate of his 1965 prediction. And he also presented his outlook for the coming decade, 1975 to 1985. They began to refer to this analysis as Moore's Law. In his 1975 speech, Moore showed that his prediction had indeed held. He also forecast a change for the upcoming decade, namely that the pace of complexity increase would slow to a doubling. When Moore published his 1965 articulation of Moore's Law, he was the director of Fairchild Semiconductor's Research and Development Laboratory. However, in just over 3 years after this publication, Moore severed his connections with the firm. By 1975, Fairchild Semiconductor was experiencing major management and technological challenges. Among the management challenges were the loss of key Fairchild Semiconductor personnel and changes to the top management of the parent company, Fairchild Camera and Instrument. On the technological side, Fairchild Semiconductor faced continued setbacks in the transfer of metal oxide technology from its research and development laboratory to its manufacturing organization. Within this context, Noyce and Moore decided to leave Fairchild Semiconductor to form a new firm directed towards the emerging application of integrated circuits for memory in digital computers. By this time, the firms with which Moore had been associated had already played important roles in the development of the high technology center known as Silicon Valley. Both Shockley Semiconductor and Fairchild Semiconductor had reinforced an existing electronics tradition in the area. More importantly, Shockley and Fairchild had been critical catalysts for the growth of the semiconductor industry through the experiences they provided for key individuals, the networks they fostered for firm creation, the production of significant wealth, and the extension of both semiconductor component and computing technologies. Moore and Noyce's decision to found a new semiconductor firm benefited from these changes and initiated a subsequent period of increased development. For example, Moore and Noyce enjoyed a far quicker and easier experience in securing the initial funding for their new company. Collaborating with a financier who helped them establish Fairchild Semiconductor a decade earlier, they founded the Intel Corporation in 1968. Their first hire for Intel was Grove, the metal oxide specialist, who by then had risen to the assistant directorship of the Fairchild Semiconductor's Research and Development Laboratory. In the firm's first year, Moore orchestrated competing internal development efforts aimed at creating a static random access memory product. Bipolar process technology competed with a hybrid assembly approach, as well as a silicon gate technology development effort. In 1969, Moore decided on the silicon gate metal oxide technology as the basis for continued product development. Between 1969 and 1972, Intel introduced three milestone products based on the silicon gate process: a DRAM chip, an EEPROM chip, and the 4004 microprocessor. In his role as executive vice president of Intel during this period, Moore took responsibility for the firm's technological direction. Moreover, Moore played a major role in several business and organizational innovations at Intel, in particular the integration of research and development functions with manufacturing, as well as the use of stock options as a major element of employee incentives. By 1972, the DRAM chip had become the world's largest selling integrated circuit and the basis for 90% of Intel's revenue. Across the 1970s and early 1980s, Moore guided the enormous growth of Intel based largely on this semiconductor memory market. From 1975 to 1979, Moore served as Intel's president and CEO, and from 1979 to 1987, he was both the CEO and the chairman of the board. In this period, Moore continued to concentrate on guiding the technology development and strategy of Intel. He coordinated an interlocking strategy for the firm's three most important product lines, the DRAMs, the EEPROMs, and the microprocessors. In the mid-1980s, the relative importance of DRAMs and microprocessors for Intel underwent a dramatic reversal. The market for Intel's microprocessors grew notably between 1980 and 1985, driven by IBM's selection of the Intel 8088 for the PC and the subsequent adoption of Intel microprocessors by IBM and other PC manufacturers. In contrast, by 1985, Intel was facing severe competition in the DRAM market by Japanese manufacturers. Intel's woes in the memory market in the early 1980s had led Moore and others at Intel to broker a deal with IBM in 1983, in which IBM took a significant stake in Intel to secure its supply of microprocessors. In 1985, Moore and Grove made the decision to reorient Intel toward the microprocessor business and began the exit from the DRAM business. In addition, Moore and Grove made another decision that year that would fundamentally restructure the microprocessor market on which the pair was betting the firm. They decided not to second source the newest Intel microprocessor, the 8386. Previously, systems producers had insisted that component manufacturers make arrangements for another firm to manufacture, under license, of course, critical components ensuring the system producer secures supplies for the devices. With the 8386, Intel determined that market conditions and its own manufacturing capability would allow it to forgo providing such a second source without a negative impact on demand. Moreover, Intel was further determined to protect its position as the sole source for the 8386 by vigorously asserting its copyright on the device's microcode. These moves made Intel the single supplier for its new microprocessor. One that was standard setter for the microcomputer architecture and one which offered full backward compatibility. The decisive actions by Moore and Grove in the mid-1980s set the stage for the uniquely successful microprocessor franchise that Intel would maintain and expand in the late 1980s and 1990s. In 1987, Grove replaced Moore as Intel's CEO, with Moore continuing in his role as chairman of the board through 1997. By which time Intel had become the world's largest semiconductor company. In this period, Moore maintained an active engagement in the firm's financial and technological strategies, involvement he continues to the present day in his role as chairman emeritus. Moore also emerged as the semiconductor industry's elder statesman. He served on the board of Varian Associates, a maker of semiconductor manufacturing equipment, and he also chaired the Semiconductor Industry Association's Technology Strategy Committee. At the Semiconductor Association, he instituted the Technology Roadmap, which articulated operational, explicit goals for the entire semiconductor industry. The continuation of Moore's Law had become the industry's organizing principle. Later in the 1990s, Moore's Law took an additional connotation as it found widespread use as an expression of the general pace of technological change associated with the explosive growth of computing and the Internet. In the late 1990s and the early 2000s, Moore increasingly turned his attention to philanthropic pursuits. With his wife, Betty Moore, he took a series of actions that have placed him in the top ranks of U.S. philanthropy. In 2000, the Moores established the Gordon Betty Moore Foundation, based in San Francisco, with an endowment of $5 billion to pursue interests in conservation, scientific research, and the San Francisco Bay Area. In 2001, through the Moore Foundation, the Moores made a $260 million gift for biodiversity conservation to the Conservation Internationale. They also pledged $600 million to support educational and research projects at California Institute of Technology. You've been listening to Computing Lives. This podcast was based on a biography that was published in Volume 28, Number 3 of the IEEE Annals of the History of Computing. It was written by Christophe Lecourrier and David Brock. More about the Annals, as well as other publications of the Computer Society, can be found at www.computer.org. To find the Annals, click on Technical Magazines. Other Computer Society podcasts can be found at www.computer.org/podcasts. If you have any comments, you can send them to podcasts@computer.org. The music for this podcast came from the Podshow PodSafe Music Network. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.